Hey, welcome back to the podcast. Today, we're doing something really special, something really unique, something I haven't done yet on this podcast that I'm really looking forward to. And this will be part one in a series of conversations on the Bible. And so multiple conversations will follow. And I'm really excited about this because today I have my really good friend Jonathan Otto on. And today we're going to be talking about this contradiction that we often see between the Old Testament and New Testament, and this contradiction that we see of the question I've had in my mind for many years: is God a vengeful God, a angry God, a jealous God, one that condemns and burns people to hell for their sins? Or is God a loving God, a caring God, a God that understands and forgives and is all compassionate? Because I don't think you can have both at the same time. I don't think that is, certainly to me, not possible. And so this conversation, we're going to deep dive into this topic, and not here to say that either of us have all the answers. We're not here to, you know, judge or say this is the absolute truth. But both of us have spent quite a bit of time not only researching the Bible, in my case, researching many different religions and traditions, but Jonathan actually has spent probably more time than most over his short life so far in really studying the Bible and really living it and really questioning it and really having deep faith. And so I'll have Jonathan share with you a little bit here about his own, you know, life of faith and his own research into the Bible. He's got some really fascinating and unique ideas that I rarely hear, even from scholars and from pastors that I've questioned over the years. And so some of the ideas that I've come to through my practice of faith are very similar to the ideas that Jonathan has shared with me. And so we've come to these same conclusions on certain topics, not on everything, but on certain topics and ideas that I think are rare in the Christian community and in, you know, in many spiritual communities that I've spoken with about these topics. And so some things we may agree on, some things we may not, some things we may disagree on, but certainly we want to have this conversation and invite you into the conversation. Share your thoughts, you know, let us know below the video. What are your questions? What are your thoughts? What do you think about what we're sharing? Because I think these are important conversations that we have, because the Bible can absolutely be misunderstood and misinterpreted. And we all probably have and are misinterpreting and misunderstanding it at different points and different areas in our life and understanding. And so for me, I think it's really important that we gain more understanding, and it's conversations like this that allow us to do it. So Jonathan, brother, thanks for coming on, man. I'm super excited to have this conversation with you.
Same here, bro, for sure. Thank you, Nathan, for the opportunity. I love this conversation because it's so deep, it's so personal. It's something that relates to everyone, in my opinion. It's something that is in someone's heart and mind continually. So if you can elevate someone's perception of God, it could change their whole belief in themselves. It can change their understanding of their own identity of who they are and the value that they possess. And so I think it's an awesome conversation. I'm super excited to share.
Yeah. Can you give a couple minutes on your background with faith?
Sure. So I grew up in a Christian family, and I questioned things a lot. I was a very skeptical child. I doubted a lot. I saw lots of what I thought was hypocrisy. And that's simply, I think, because I was trying to find what I wanted to be like. And so it's natural that a child will, you know, look to see, you know, what's real and what's not, and then say, I don't really think that these people are for real, or these kinds of things. And so I had a lot of doubts about faith, about God, about Christianity. I had a lot of doubts about all of this, and I was very much drawn at an early age into humanitarian work, and I felt like it was like a substitute, like that this is actually what people need. They need to do things for others. And this whole thing about faith is really kind of a distraction that makes people feel good about themselves potentially, but then has no real world impact and actually takes people away from the front line of service and love and care and saving people from starvation. And these were the thoughts that I had in my mind. And so I quite resented many aspects of it. I don't think I've told you about that, Nathan. And I and I had a bit of a chip on my shoulder with it, and certain things that I guess that was that they were the factors that came together for me that made me feel like I just don't know about all of this. And they were at age 19, then I started studying the Bible very deeply myself. And it was out of a drive. Like I felt a need. There came this point where I felt like, as much as I wanted to try to do, I really felt lacking in myself, that there was a gaping hole, and that my self-worth or my perception of myself and my desire to achieve and perform and to do things that were socially acceptable and to, you know, be powerful and important, and all these things were driving me on this pendulum where I was swinging up and down with my self-worth. And so I was high and then low and then high and low, and it was driving me crazy. And so I just remembered just breaking down in tears, you know, continually thinking, what is wrong? Like I don't like this equation of life. And so it caused me to then go deeper into asking the question, do I need God? And this came up because I then started to feel like I can kind of understand what people need when they pursue a relationship with God. And I feel like there's something missing in my life and I can't find it. I can't find it in success. I can't find it in girls. I can't find it in pursuits, or I just can't find it. And so then this then caused me to open the Bible and to start to study it deeply and to seek to understand it. And that actually, I saw it change lots of different aspects of my life. It got to the point where, you know, over the years, absolutely thousands upon thousands of hours in all kinds of aspects of the Bible, from prophecy of how the Bible predicted future events that have historically, you know, happened and come to pass, and then others that I see all the signs that they're happening even in the midst of us now. And then this deeper conversation that came around a concept called theodicy, which is not theology, theodicy, which is the pursuit of God's character to understand it. And I felt that something about that was deeply connected to who I am. And there were these contradictions that I couldn't resolve, which was these ideas of a vengeful God, which then to me showed up in a few things, which were, one, films and entertainment that was highly stimulating, that often had themes of violence, punishment, and then also like a sexual drive that was, I could see it was out of whack, and it, you know, the desire for things that were disassociated and disconnected. For example, discovering pornography when I was a mid teenager, and then realizing that this is bad, quote unquote, getting it out of my life, and then yet finding why do I want things like this? And then realizing it was connected to my pursuit for God and me not finding comfort in God, me actually having, without me realizing, a vengeful view of God, this thing that you talked about, where it had a canceling effect, because I grew up Christian. So Christian belief frequently teaches that God stands as the judge over the human race and will, you know, decide whether you're good enough, and then will... Yeah, basically, if you really think about it, most Christians are living under a condemnation that they will, you know, potentially never size up for God, and then be ultimately thrown out and rejected by God and even tortured by God in a place called hell. And these things tormented me without me even realizing, and it was driving these other things. And I only really saw, I only actually realized this was the driving force behind it until started to study the Bible and realized that my beliefs on God were false, and they came through a reflection of myself, and others were teaching a reflection of themselves. And so this became a widely accepted teaching, but it once I uprooted it, then these behaviors, these thoughts, these beliefs, these patterns all disappeared, and I saw myself free from these chains that even people that are, you know, completely secular and atheistic often, you know, want to get rid of, like a pornography addiction would prefer a deep connection with their spouse or something of that manner. And I definitely, you know, was really grateful to find that. So that's kind of how it all comes full circle for me.
Yeah, beautiful. And we can get into more specific stories and experiences that you've gone through over the years too. And I'll share a little bit about my background in a minute. But first, I want to talk about this what we see in the Old Testament, right, where we see like a vengeful God. There's a pretty classic example, 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 2, thus saith the Lord of hosts, I remember that which Amalek did to Israel, how laid wait for him in the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass. And Saul gathered the people together and numbered them into lame, 200,000 footmen, 10,000 men of Judah, right? And so this is basically, and there's multiple examples in the Old Testament where it shows, you know, God condoning death and violence and killing.
Have you heard of PEMF therapy for cancer? Well, this podcast is brought to you by Dr. Pollock, and he wants to share with you the groundbreaking research of pulsed electromagnetic field therapy in the treatment of cancer. Studies show PEMF therapy can help control the cancer process and give safe, non-toxic, and non-invasive symptom management. PEMF therapy may enhance other cancer support and treatments, lower inflammation, and promote tissue healing. Studies show it's possible to improve your general well-being and recuperate from surgery, radiation, and chemo better and more quickly. Embrace a comprehensive approach to cancer treatment with PEMF therapy, a vital tool on your path to prevention, treatment, and recovery. For caring and professional guidance and recommendations from Dr. Pollock, go to drpollock.com/intro to cancer. That's drpawluk.com/intro to cancer. You know, with the cold and flu season here, it's critically important that we enhance and strengthen our immune systems. Yes, would you agree? The problem is, though, that there's so much confusion out there when it comes to what actually works for our bodies and for our health. Well, I'll tell you what I used. I used Maison Beljansky's wellness products. Maison Beljansky's products are backed by science to not only help empower the immune system, but can support detoxification and contribute to our overall health. Coming from Europe, the all-natural Beljansky formulas are now available in the United States and are recommended by top doctors everywhere. A lot of the colleagues I work with, functional medicine practitioners that work with patients with all kinds of diseases, are recommending Maison Beljansky's products to their very own patients. As a special sponsor of this podcast, Maison Beljansky has included a very special discount offer for all of my listeners. You can get 15% off your first order using the promo code Nathan, and you'll always enjoy free shipping when you order four products or more. You can grab your wellness products today at MaisonBeljansky.com. That's MaisonBeljansky, MaisonBeljansky.com, and use code Nathan for 15% off.
You know, a lot of these concepts, this vengeful God concept that we have. And so, you know, but there are very many, so I do want to say the contradiction is there are many Old Testament passages where God is portraying love, where God is merciful, right? And then many in the New Testament as well. And so, you know, this is that kind of contradiction, and I think where we get confused. Also, this is slightly off track, but I want to mention it because I have it right here, is this word fear, right? And so I'm a God-fearing man, right? We hear that a lot. And throughout the Old Testament, you'll see, you know, Deuteronomy 13:4, which is actually Deuteronomy, is that New Testament?
No, Old Testament no, still.
That's Old Testament. Right. Yeah, ye shall walk after the Lord your God and fear him and keep his commandments and obey his voice, and ye shall serve him and cleave unto him. Deuteronomy 6:2, that thou mightest fear the Lord thy God to keep all his statutes and his commandments, on and on. 6:5, and thou shalt, now it says, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might. So that contradiction, fear and love. What's really been so helpful for me as I really dive into deeper research into the Bible, I've, over my last 20 years or so on kind of my spiritual journey, I have, you know, gone through various aspects of researching parts of the Bible, like not the whole thing in depth like I'm doing now. I'm doing from beginning to end every single day, reading it, praying on it, reading the meanings of the words, the original Aramaic or Hebrew or Greek meanings of the words, right? And writing about it and meditating on it and praying on it. So I did that in small pieces, chunks throughout the Bible over the years, and now I'm doing the whole Bible that way. And the thing that's helped me so much is the app that you sent me, SKJV, right, which is Strong's King James Version. It's a free app. And basically, you can click on a word and see what the original definition of that word is. And so when I looked up fear, what is the original meaning of fear in the original language? It's to revere, right? To respect, not to be afraid of, but to respect, to revere. Reverence for something is significantly different than what we think of today as fear for something. Yeah. And that's why I got chills thinking about it, because it changes the whole meaning of every time you read the word fear God in the Bible. See, here it says fear God, love God, right? What it's saying is revere God, love God. Now the contradiction's gone. Now it makes sense. It's saying love God, respect God, revere God. But we take the word fear literal today instead of understanding the original language it was written in. And that to me was like a huge, because I came to the same concept even without being a Christian, even without, you know, going to church. I came to this same concept 15, 16 years ago, that God is love. God is nothing but love. God only loves us, only has compassion for us, only wants us to do good, only is here to serve us, to help guide us to our highest good, to show us a loving, pure, happy, joyful life. I came to that conclusion on my own, just like you did. We did it through different paths. But now it's like I'm seeing these ways as I study the Bible of where, you know, misunderstandings have led people into a dark life. Because if you're afraid of something, right, fear prevents you from making your highest decision for the highest good. We know this psychologically. We know that if you're afraid of something, you often will make poor choices. So why would God want us to make poor choices? I'm afraid of God. Now I'm going to make poor choices. That doesn't even make sense psychologically. But when you revere God, I respect God, and I love God. Now my whole brain is hardwired, literally designed to help me make good choices in my life, for my family, for my future, for my health, for humanity, right? And so understanding these deeper meanings of the words is essential, I think, in our pursuit of the truth, in our pursuit of the truth to God. You know, one of the most important things I've learned over the years in helping many people get and stay healthy is to help them shift their mindset into thinking of themselves as an athlete, no matter their age, whether they just walk 30 minutes a day in the mornings, for example, or they play sports for fun on the weekends, or they go to the gym a couple days a week. No matter what your activity level, if you think of yourself as an athlete, then you start to naturally take better care of your body, focus more on your nutrition, recovery, sleep, other health protocols that optimize your performance as an athlete, and in turn may help you prevent and heal against chronic diseases and help your body be the healthiest that it can possibly be. So if you want to live a long, healthy, vital life and start thinking of yourself as an athlete, head over to plantpoweredathlete.com and get the latest organic, plant-powered protein, super clean, nutrient-dense, high-quality plant-powered protein to help you live your healthiest, most vital life. And you can use our discount code PANACEA15 for 15% discount off your first order. Again, that's plantpoweredathlete.com. Get some of the plant-powered protein for yourself and start thinking of yourself as an athlete every day and see how it impacts your health for the long term. All right, let's get to the show.
Wow. Yeah, no, I love that. And look, I think you're nailing it. And I think that this is such an important conversation, and you get these points and you're willing to study to see what these ancient texts teach, and look at these root words. What do they mean? And I love that study around fear, because it's put in contrast. If you look at 1 John 4:8, it says, perfect love casts out fear, for fear has torment, and he that fears is not made perfect in love. Isn't that interesting? And anyone that is really believes in the Bible and says this is my text for life doesn't generally believe that there's this contradiction. It's not supposed to be there. If there's a contradiction, it's a contradiction in your own understanding, and it's one that's there designed to help you wrestle with something. It's there to use your mind to work through it. And then, yeah, you keep clicking on the word fear, and you keep looking at the root of, even the root of reverence has to do with admiration. It's
right.
about beholding and seeing something that draws you and is awe-inspiring. So think about the word awful. I mean, awful is full of awe. So we would use the word awful to say something is bad, but that you're in awe of that. So that actually, the same word, even in just in English, could be used to describe something horrible or something beautiful. Why is something that denotes awe, necessarily then couched as being negative? Same thing is true for the word wrath and anger. So these are words that you would say, well, wrath of God, anger, these are clearly negative words, Jonathan. You can't get around this, but it's an Old English word. So you've got to understand it in the Old English, not whatever you think it means or whatever your pastor think it means. What does the text actually teach? And the power in something like Strong's Concordance was, formulated by James Strong, is not because he was brilliant. It's because he was getting every verse on the subject and looking at every possible meaning for this word based on the context. So not making up words, saying this is what this means in every context, hence why it comes up with different meanings. But fear and anger translate, the words are like, for example, in Hebrew, af, and in Greek, orge. Orge is where we get the word orgasm. Isn't that strange? And even origami is interesting. Like you look at, because it, which is to fold, but the word orge is very similar to the word af, which means to quiver, which is what people have when they're in like either pleasure, anger, or immense pain. And so now translate it. Okay, so God is, and the af, for example, is rapid breathing through the nose and to quiver, the body to shake. And so the wrath of God is actually the suffering of God. And then you look at the words, for example, suffering and long suffering, these words are examples of that. So they're used like in similar fashion. So when God is suffering, then these words can get translated as words that are denoted and closely connected to anger and wrath. And so people say, okay, God is angry at me versus God is suffering because of my choices. So different. And then
Hang on, let's pause there for a second. Cause yeah, that is such a different perspective to think that the wrath is not the wrath of God condemning you, the wrath of his anger towards you. The root of that actually being almost, God, almost that God is sad, right? That like that there's almost a sadness there because you are walking away from God when God is opening his loving arms to you.
Yeah.
And on that note, there's a, so Galatians 5:22, right? That's to New Testament. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith. Right? In Galatians 5:13, for brethren, you have been called into liberty. Only use not liberty for an occasion to the flesh, but by love serve one another. For all the law is fulfilled in one word, even in this, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. But if ye bite and devour one another, take heed that ye be not consumed one of another. This I say then, walk in the Spirit, which already said the Spirit is peace and gentleness and goodness and faith, and ye shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. And so we can find way more. Actually, if you do the research and compare how many times a loving God, a compassionate God, a peaceful God is portrayed from Old Testament to New Testament, I don't know what the exact ratio is, but it's significantly more that it's positive. And then as we go deeper to understand these root words of the ones where we see this wrathful, you know, angry God, we start to understand that the interpretations of that into our modern language have been misinterpreted. Imagine unlocking the power of your immune system with the turn of a key. That's exactly what Better Way Health's beta-glucan offers, a clinically proven cheat code for immune support, now available at a special discount. This unique formula combines the synergistic effects of beta-glucan with vitamin C, resveratrol, and selenium, boosting immune function, energy, mood, and overall performance. It's 8 times more potent than its top competitors. It's vegan, non-GMO, and gluten-free. And our friends at Better Way Health are saying, don't miss this opportunity to shield your health with a product backed by rigorous research and literally thousands of studies. Elevate your wellness journey with Better Way Health's beta-glucan and experience the difference in days, not weeks. Secure your supply today and feel the invincible shield up around your health. Just like countless satisfied customers worldwide, I actually take this beta-glucan myself and I highly recommend it. You can visit nathancrane.com/beta-glucan. That's BETAGLUCAN. nathancrane.com/beta-glucan for a special discount today. One of my good friends and integrative cancer doctors, Michael Karlfeldt, owns the Karlfeldt Center in Meridian, Idaho. And I'm really grateful that their team has sponsored this episode. Dr. Karlfeldt is a globally renowned naturopathic doctor in integrative oncology, and his center pioneers cutting-edge alternative therapies to combat cancer. They offer cutting-edge therapies, including high-dose IVs, ozone therapy, curcumin, mistletoe, photodynamic therapy, and many others within their 17,000 square foot advanced medical and wellness treatment facility. With decades of expertise, they offer comprehensive root cause medicine tailored to support your healing journey. You can begin your transformative experience with a complimentary 15-minute discovery call. You can call them at 208-338-8902 or visit their website at thekarlfeldtcenter.com. Again, that's 208-338-8902, or go to the website, thekarlfeldtcenter.com. Let's talk about Healing 951. I first learned about this revolutionary product while attending a conference on natural cancer treatments. I then later interviewed Jim at Healing Products, and his cancer healing journey with this product truly inspired me. Healing 951 stands out for its profound effects on gut health, inflammation, cellular health, and immune system support. Unlike typical supplements, Healing 951 offers scientifically backed, tangible benefits and an over 30-year track record. Many of my listeners worldwide use Healing 951 not only as part of their cancer recovery, but also for general health and athletic performance. I use it myself as well. I really encourage you to head over to healing951.com/crane for exclusive deals and free shipping when you use code CRANE. If you're facing serious health challenges, call Healing Products and mention my name. Their team, with over 3 decades of expertise, is incredibly supportive. Don't wait. Experience the healing difference today. That's healing951.com/crane.
Yeah, you got it. You got it. It's and a huge takeaway here, Nathan, to prove what you're saying is true and what I'm saying is true, where it becomes undeniable is the revelation of Jesus. Because if we didn't have that, then it would become very debatable. We could go and look at these and say, well, look, wrath is used to describe when people are actually angry and want to murder somebody. They're used in this context, and it can be used. It's a dual word. It can be used to denote long suffering. So which one is it? And you really can't work it out. You just have to sit there and go, well, I want it to be the good one. But then where do you have this strong evidence that, no, it absolutely is the good one. There's no way around this. There's no way to resolve the contradiction. And the answer to that is through Jesus. And there is a reason why Jesus is the most famous figure in all history. And it's not because he was like an Alexander the Great, that he conquered many armies. It's actually the opposite. It's that he was so meek, and the miracles that were recorded and these things were profound, and But the thing that really like topped it all off was his lack of violence, period. And especially his lack of violence when under the most horrific threats.
Right.
Like you have a servant of the high priest Malchus taking him to get executed, and then he has one of his followers that thinks of things in a more militia type sense, like let's fight back. It's a normal human behavior. Tries to basically take off the head of this guy, just hits the ear off. The ear's on the ground. He picks it up, puts it on his back on his face, and here he is being led to his death. And so this is a very ennobling thought to think about somebody that would be, you know, willing to submit themselves into the hands of their betrayers and then be even in this case crucified, and then still not to call down, you know, fire and judgment on people. And the words that come from his lips are, "Father, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing." And so now, is this something that we just take and say, okay, well, here's this other side to God, and here's this other side to God from the Old Testament, and, you know, you better get your life right, otherwise the other God is going to come out? Or is this just the consistent way that God is, that this is a full revelation of God's love in Christ, and then our understanding of Christ then illuminates the rest of the scriptures and helps us understand? There's a beautiful passage in 2 Corinthians 3:14, and it says, "But their minds were blinded, for until this day remains the same veil untaken away in the reading of the Old Testament, which veil is done away with in Christ." And like New King James is a little bit easier, "But their minds were blinded, for until this day the same veil remains unlifted in the reading of the Old Testament, because the veil is taken away in Christ." I mean, there's a veil, like there's something that's obstructing your reading of the Old Testament, or of the systems, or the sacrificial system of with the lambs and all these things. This is all obstructed because of your own self. Because your own self requires sacrifice. And until people can work this out, they won't work it out. Because unless you can work out that you require sacrifice, then it doesn't make sense why God is even speaking through these symbols. And then you come and you see that even Jesus didn't even partake in the sacrificial system. At the Passover, he's eating, you know, wine, which translates to grapes, so it could be fermented or not, considering that you see more evidence for non-fermented. People will kind of scoff at that, but, you know, John the Baptist was forbidden from drinking any alcohol. His parents, Samson's parents, were told he is not to drink any strong drink. When Christ was receiving the wine on the cross, it says he refused it, and to like numb the pain, he refused it. So my point being there, specifically just getting to the point, it was bread, and it was a grape juice of whatever kind. It was not even the sacrificial lamb. And so, you know, the death system is really a human system. And when people realize that, then they start realizing that the only way for God to now reach humanity is by agreeing with their psychology to lead them out of it. And because, you know, people are convinced in a reality, you can't convince them out of it. And so the purchase price of the human race, the need for a blood sacrifice, for example, Christ to die instead of us, because the whole ethos of Christianity is that Christ died in my place to take away the death penalty that was owed to me, that God was going to have to pay to me, and he was going to have to execute me out of my sins for what I've done. And it's so hard for people to escape this, because we've all known what we've done wrong. And imagine if you took the life of somebody who did something that was irreversible. And all of us have done irreversible things that have hurt people. Now, how do you just believe that you just get off the hook? That's not fair. It's not right. It's not okay. So then the demand for there to be a death penalty is within your own soul. And so you need to see the death penalty enacted. And then that's the window for you to even believe that you could be saved by God. And so you see Christ come, and then all the people that are involved in crucifying him are all disobeying God. You know, Pilate is given a vision from his wife. An angel comes to her in a dream or vision, says, "Have nothing to do with this innocent man." And then Pilate is then washing his hands, saying, "It's not my fault." He then later suicides. If you look at the history of Pilate, it's not recorded in the Bible, but it's recorded in history. God was trying to save him from this fate. God was trying to save all the different people from doing this wrong thing. It wasn't his plan, but it was one that he was able to reach us through. And then you come back, you start unlocking all the scriptures of the Old Testament and realizing that God was showing mirrors to the human soul of their death and violence. And even passages like what you started on, the command to kill the Amalekites, this was horrific because it specifically appears that God is condoning the killing of not only women, but children, not only children, but infants and sucklings, 1 Samuel 15, verse 3. To kill infants and sucklings, commanded by the Lord, and you'll find Christians just having to find a way to justify it. But then, how do you have any value with God when a child like this could be executed? When, I mean, who has more sin in their life, me or that Amalekite child that's born into a pagan tribe that is involved in lots of dark and evil things? But that child is, it's nursing on its mother's breast. It has not done anything. I've got far more to account for. Now, my belief that God is okay with killing these infants then now reflects on my own worth to God. I'm obviously worth nothing to God if this child's not, because I've done worse. And so just understanding that when, even if you look at the passage, Young's literal translation translates it way differently. It says, Saul, you have killed Amalek. You have killed man, woman, and infant and suckling, instead of the King James, which again, I'm not saying the King James is a bad translation, but I am saying that you have to then do your own referencing to understand, because you're at the mercy of the translator that took it from the original into the into English in this case. And so Saul is seeing a mirror of his own soul. He's decided himself to kill the Amalekites. God is now showing him what he's planned to do. And in the Young's literal, he's saying that you have done this. And so it's an example that then now alleviates God from being the one that's harming and killing. And then you're seeing God now, you know, interact with people within their own psyche. And James 1:23 says, if a man is a hearer of the word, not a doer, it is as if he's beholding his natural appearance in a mirror, going away and forgetting the manner of person that he was. So you're looking at a mirror when you're looking at it. You're seeing Saul's darkness and violence, and God is reflecting it back to him. It's why you also see passages where it says that the Lord repented of the evil that he thought to do to Israel, which makes no sense to a Christian, because they would say, well, I'm a Christian, by the way, so I'm not, but I'm saying that it makes no sense to somebody that believes that God does not repent. Why? He doesn't do anything wrong, so why would he repent? And he does not do evil. And it's the same word evil as used in the tree of knowledge of good and evil, evil angels. It's the same word. So he repented of the evil that he thought to do Israel. And in this case, he's reflecting the spirit of Moses towards the people. And Moses is the one that he's thinking these thoughts of, let's get rid of them. And this is why God says, I'll destroy these people. I'll make of you a great nation. But it's a mirror of the soul of Moses, showing him what he has planned and what he's thinking in his mind. And then Moses then responds and says, God, don't do this thing. And it brings out of him, by him seeing a mirror of himself, it brings about this change. And this is why the Lord repented of the evil that he thought to do to Israel, because it's Moses seeing himself turning, his own heart turn, and God's reflecting it back to him. Super powerful to see it.
So this is kind of similar to the story of Arjuna and Krishna, or Arjuna and God in the battlefield, where this comes from the Bhagavad Gita, which comes from the ancient Indian texts. And the, you know, Arjuna is basically this great warrior. And, you know, this is a story to teach us basically exactly what you're saying. You know, this text came anywhere between, depends on the scholars, you know, 1500 BC to potentially 4000, 5000 BC. But basically, the story is that Arjuna then goes out and sees all of his, you know, these are neighboring tribes, these are cousins, these are aunts, these are uncles, these are family and friends, right? But they have to have this great war, this great battle, because they're warriors, and, you know, who's going to, you know, dominate and own the land and so forth. And Arjuna goes out and he sees all of these family members among them. And he has this conversation with God, and he says, how can you tell me to, you know, how can I live with myself knowing that I will kill, you know, my brothers and sisters and cousins and aunts and uncles and these innocent people, these family members. I would rather die. I would rather die in shame than, than to, you know, kill all of these people, even though I know it's my duty. This is my responsibility. And so God is talking to Arjuna, and basically, you know, almost as yours, I see it almost as a mirror, is what you're saying, is like this conversation, this reflection, where Arjuna is coming to this realization through these questions and conversation of bearing and opening his own soul to the truth within. Wow. And, you know, so that's a really fascinating example of what you're talking about, which goes back to, you know, ancient Indian texts as well, which to slightly on 2 minutes on kind of my background was, you know, I've studied and continue to study in depth, you know, multiple ancient texts and religions, from, you know, the Vedas and the Bhagavad Gita to Buddhist texts and Buddhist religions to Taoists and Taoism. Native Americans, I've spent many, many hours in ceremonies and conversations and spiritual discussions with multiple Native American tribes over the years, and have, you know, and have spent time in Christian churches and Catholic churches and other, you know, various religions, as I study and am looking for, you know, my direct understanding and connection to God. And what I have found so fascinating is in all of these ancient traditions, every single one, whether it's Buddhism, it's Hinduism, it's the Vedas, it's these ancient traditions, you know, every single one of them portrays God as a loving God, portrays God as a compassionate God, portrays God as a, you know, all-knowing, all-compassionate, all-loving God. And so I had that already kind of knowingness through some experience I had early on, almost 20 years ago, and then through my own meditations and starting to know that for myself. And then I came across the Bible, you know, I thought, wow, there's these interesting contradictions here. So this idea that you shared of maybe we're seeing a mirror of ourselves, or a mirror of, you know, the characters in the Bible, is very interesting, right? That's a fascinating way to look at it. But then the idea too of the, when you talked about, you know, through Jesus is where we can really, you know, understand the truth, because like Matthew 5:38, you have heard that it was said, eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. So back to your point of, you know, Jesus, even in so many opportunities to be a representation of, you know, condemnation and judgment and anger and so forth, even tells his disciples, turn the other cheek if someone attacks you, right? Meaning, do not fight back, right? This is peace. This is peaceful non-resistance, as Gandhi taught, peaceful resistance, as Gandhi taught. And then, you know, John 14:6. So this is probably a conversation for another time, but I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. And there are so many examples of that same, you know, written in different ways, where Jesus talks about, you know, believe in me, trust in me, follow me, do as I do. Through me is where you connect to the Father. Through me is how you become one with God. And how I interpret that, and I have to, you know, pull up more passages to really back this up, but I've read them over the years, is that when we do as Jesus did, when we live as Jesus did, when we do what he talks about in the Bible, right? We are compassionate, we are loving, we are forgiving, we are generous, we are caring, right? We are kind and forgiving. We follow Jesus. That through Jesus, through his example, is how we then become one with God, how we then are, you know, truly our highest selves, our highest potential. And I know in Christianity, there's this belief that you're born sinner, natural born sinner, and I will always be a sinner no matter what. And I don't believe that. I don't judge anybody's beliefs in that, but I've seen in my own life and many others that we can continue to heal this part of ourselves and follow what Jesus taught and learn to, I'm not there yet, but eventually get to a place where we no longer sin. We no longer have sin within us, that we can perfect our souls just as Jesus taught us to do. He said, you shall do what I do and even greater things than these. He's telling us that by following him, that doing as he teaches, that we too shall do, you know, these great things, that we can overcome sin. And to me, that is, you know, born in the image of God. God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness. This is Genesis, right? But then you go further on and you see, you know, when John talks about John 1:7, the same come from a witness to bear witness of the light, that all men through him might believe. He was not that light, but was sent to bear witness of the light. That was the true light, which lighteth every man that cometh to the world. He was in the world, and the world was made by him, and the world knew him not. He came unto his own, and his own received him not. But as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name. Believe on his name. So that's another one of those words that I researched, right? Believe, what does that mean? Does that just mean have faith or just believe that it's true? No, the real original meaning of believe is literally to follow, to put your trust in, to follow the example, right? It's like to not just believe that something's there, but to fully commit yourself to it. And so we believe in his name, and we believe in him and what he does and teaches us, then he too become the sons of God. And so, you know, that might be a whole conversation for another Bible conversation. But to me, Jesus was the example. He was the leader. He was the teacher. He was showing us the way to God. Do as I do, follow as I do, be as I do, and you too shall know God as I know God. And you may agree with that or not, but that's my perception, you know?
No, I see it. I think the core thing and I think you're making such a powerful point around Christ showing us how to know God. And so if you follow the actions of Christ and you follow the beliefs of how he interacted, even with people that really did deserve punishment, quote unquote, in our minds, then you land at a very nonviolent view, and it has a very ennobling effect. And strangely enough, it actually promotes something which I would, you know, refer to as on that liberation, because really, if you have everything within you and you don't have any problems, to me, I don't really think you need God or you don't need this study. But to me, I just haven't been able to escape my own condemnation and violence. And I know that some of it came through programming, through like false beliefs in Christianity, but I know that so much of it is not even connected to that. It was something that was there, like the inherent belief that punishment is due. I've seen that in just so many different cultures, and I see it deeply within me, like regardless of religious texts. And so to me, this gives people the ability to identify something, put their finger on a problem they actually have without realizing, and then bring it to the fore and heal it. And that's why I think it's so powerful about this study, because it's actually all about self-reflection, saying, this is the violence in me. Everything I thought about the judgment of God, of standing before God on a day of judgment and God saying, I don't know if I like this guy. And, you know, I've got two beautiful boys, the 3 and 5 year old, and they're my world. And if they thought of me like that, that I was one day going to decide whether I wanted to keep them or not, it would just break my heart. I just couldn't even describe in words how much it would hurt me to think that they would think that about me. But it would make sense why we'd have these reoccurring images, because it's naturally how we treat people. Look at the political debates and look at how people love to just tear apart the other side. And it's designed that way. It's low vibe frequency. It's really dark, because it's all about saying, you know what? We'd be better if we didn't have that guy. I wish that guy didn't miss. I wish we could take that guy out. And these things come so naturally to us. And I'm disturbed to see that within myself. But God can heal us of these things. And
absolutely,
that's why, to me, Christianity has so much to offer. Like, when I say Christianity, I mean Christ. Because Christianity means a little Christ or a follower of Christ, that not the world religion that has been kind of espouses the name, which many of which, you've got great examples And that's one of the things I started to find, wow, all this humanitarian work, why is it all these Christian groups are involved in this? So, and you saw that when we were out in Kenya together, and you see people responding. So there's a beautiful aspect there. So I'll give credit where it's due. And then you see this militant side where, why are they more likely sometimes to be like calling down judgment on people, be harsh? And but this wasn't the ethos of Christ. It wasn't the actions of Christ. But anyway, to conclude the other point I was making about what you were saying, Christ is showing us how to be. And it's you can't go wrong. Any Christian would say, well, just you can't go wrong if you follow Jesus, follow his actions, follow his life, follow his teachings. And if you're confused about the Old Testament and you don't understand how it all fits, well, he's there to help you understand it all anyway. And that's direct revelation. So think about it this way. I could have people tell you about me. Or let's say if your children want to know who you are, they didn't get to know who you are. And then they you had people teach them about who you were. And then you even somehow through some kind of telecommunication were able to have me share with you teachings and words, and I was then also not a robot, and God is now not like automatic writing controlling my mind. He's actually inspiring me, and it says that specifically in the Bible. It doesn't say that he basically like takes over their hands and starts writing. He's inspiring them. And so they're writing under inspiration. That's why you see all these fascinating prophecies that came true to the T. I think I showed you the prophecies on Christ. They were so accurate to a T, things that were outside of Jesus' control. Like he couldn't control that he would get pierced in his hands and feet. Why did it predict it in Psalm 22? Why it, you know, quotes the words, my God, why have you forsaken me? Which he quotes then from the cross. And it says the garments are parted and sold. All of these different prophecies were in that one, even just that one chapter of Psalm 22, written 1,000 years before Christ, as dated by the Dead Sea Scrolls, as then backed by, you know, actual language motifs and kings, different things that could only be known and written during those times and have no ability to be fabricated in a true historical sense, which is why it's not debated. So it has such tremendous ability to relay important facts. And yet you're getting a message through a vessel. And so now how much more powerful if you have the person where you then now directly come to your children and say, hey guys, this is me. And now if you now trump the actual revelation of Nathan, that your father with your son, you know, and your daughter Luna and your son, Osha, and then they now then just default and say, well, you know what? I'm just going to go back to my other view that I had, and I'm just going to let this cancel out the view that I clearly have of you as you hold me in your arms and you reveal to me who you are. And then I see you in the worst possible situation, the cross, the crucifixion. And look, you still are unchanging. And this is why you see chapters like John 10, or I think it's John 10 or 13, having loved his own that were in the world, he loved them until the end. And that's such a beautiful passage because you say you love them until when? Until until it was too much. No, but he says until the end, meaning the end of his existence. He breathed his last breaths without condemning a soul ever during his whole life. And in the worst circumstance, they're laughing at him. He's naked. He's dying a death that, you know, the cross, the word excruciating comes from the word crucifixion to describe the amount of pain that he was experiencing, which then wasn't even matched by the emotional pain of being betrayed by his friends and leaders. And, you know, and then to be, you see all the conversation, Father, why have you forsaken me? Or it actually says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Which actually can refer to the rulers actually, which is interesting. Rulers, why have you forsaken me? Because he actually never referred to his father as God. He would refer to him as my father. And that's why you see, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. But the loss of his relationship, like that break with his father's love, that was the anguish of soul that the Bible talks about. He's willing to do all this. He's being mocked in this. He never retaliates. And so if you cannot take this as the revelation of God's love to your soul and to realize that he never gives up on you, and that the words that are even in the Old Testament, which is everlasting, love, everlasting mercy. His mercy is new every morning. Everlasting, these words, is olam, which means without end. It can goes on and on and on, and there is no end to it. And then you start realizing there's no end to this love. And so where does the end come from? It comes from you. It's where you decide, I've had enough of this. And then God can't restrict you from your free will. And whatever you say then comes back to you. And then you think that God is condemning you. And that's why the Bible seems so confusing, because God is a mirror to your soul. So he repeats to you back what you are. You love the passage in Psalm 19 or 18. To the upright, I appear as upright. To the pure, I appear as pure. But to the crooked, I appear as, to the crooked or twisted, I appear as torturous. So you see in God what you are. And so God is always trying to rescue us from that. And you'll see Christ even said, what I speak in darkness, that preach you in light. And darkness is not talking about what he's talking about during the nighttime. Tell people during the daytime. That doesn't actually make any sense. What I speak in darkness, that preach you in light. I'll give you the passage. And
no, what was the one about, what was the passage for basically the mirror of, if you see me as
James 1:23 and Matthew 10:26 is the one I referred to you. And so you see these interesting passages, Matthew 10:26, whatever I tell you in the dark, speak in the light, whatever you hear in the ear, preach on the housetops, do not feel. And then he now illustrates what he's about to do, because he's speaking in darkness and then in light. Right, you'll love this. And why would you do it? Why would you speak in darkness, which is specifically described as satanic? If you look at it's in Acts of Corinthians, that we would take them from light, darkness to light, from the power of Satan unto God. So now light and darkness are defined as the power of Satan and then the power of God, contrasted, that we would take them from darkness to light, from the power of Satan unto God so it gives you the rule to understand what it means. So what I speak to you in the power of Satan, like dark, violent, satanic, concepts, you understand this in light. And then you'd say, why would you do this? And then he illustrates what he's about to do. And then he says, do not fear those that can kill the body, but cannot kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. So now why is God telling us to fear now? Now the next verse says, but do not be afraid, because you are, even a sparrow falls to your ground without your father. He will fall to the ground without your father noticing. Do not be afraid, because you're of much more value than a sparrow. Do not be afraid. Why is he saying then to fear, not be afraid? It's the mirror of your soul, so that you can understand the judgment, condemnation that you are under, because it's your decree. It's coming from you. And so you will stand before that judgment, which is judge not lest you be judged, for whatever judgment you measure upon others, it will be measured upon you. It's coming from you. So you've got to deal with the problem. And this is why you look at somebody that's committing mass genocide. How do you think that they will stand before themselves on the day of judgment? The judgment that they've judged upon others then comes back to them in full force, because it's coming from themselves, and God can't save them from it because it's their choice. And that's where you really see the battle here is over the soul, and God trying to navigate with what people understand.
Yeah, that's so powerful. And so that reminds me of Ephesians 4:31. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice, and be ye kind one to another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you. And then Matthew 6:14, for if ye forgive men their trespass, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. And also, when he's speaking to Jacob about people not honoring God, right, in Isaiah 43, he says, I am he that blotteth out thy transgressions for my own sake, and will not remember thy sins. So, this idea that we, from Old Testament, New Testament, there are so many examples of forgiveness and kindness, and no matter what we've done, if there's an action there, right? If we forgive, we are forgiven. So it's not saying sit there and do nothing, continue being a bad person, right? It's saying forgive others. And to forgive others, if anybody's ever practiced forgiveness, it's very difficult to forgive others, especially when you haven't forgiven yourself. And when you forgive yourself, the powerful things that happened in your life, in my own life, when I forgave those who I condemned, my own family members, things that I didn't understand when I was, you know, homeless on the streets, you know, addicted to drugs and alcohol. My mother kicked me out of the house, and I, you know, tried, you know, going back to live with her, and she couldn't handle me. She didn't know what to do with me. I mean, I was a wild addict, 15-year-old kid that was, you know, in and out of jail and addicted to drugs. And so she, you know, no, I can't help you. And so I harbored that resentment until I was 19 years old, you know, didn't talk to her for years, changed my life, started committing myself to being healthy, to knowing God, to healing myself, my mind, my spirit. And when I forgave her and realized that it wasn't her, right? It was me forgiving her. It was my resentment that I held, my anger that I held, my sadness that I held towards her. It freed me. It freed me from that, you know, negativity within myself. So just as Jesus teaches, and even as God says in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, you know, we have to forgive others. And when we do, we also are forgiven. When I forgave my own mother, I was forgiven. It, like, think about that for a second as a metaphor. I was forgiven of that sin that I held inside myself. I literally heard this like explosion on the phone, like this electric shock on the phone, and I felt this weight lifted off of me. And so I feel like there's a lot of very practical advice in the Bible like this that are saying, do these things and you will see what happens. Because as I've done them in my own life, and then, you know, Keisha Ewers, I've shared her story many times where she forgave the babysitter who molested her child. You know, she didn't know about it till years later. And then she grew a breast tumor, and she knew it was from when she found out about that babysitter molest her child when she was much younger, when they were much younger. And then all of a sudden, in like 3 months, she grew a breast tumor. She knew it was from that anger and resentment, not only towards the babysitter, but towards herself. How could I allow this to happen under my own roof, you know, to my child? What a terrible person I am. Boom, breast tumor. She was smart enough to know. And so she forgave him and forgave herself. And in months, the breast tumor went away, right? So it's like this divine power within us for healing. We know this with the cancer patients that we work with and the work that you do with cancer. And I've seen it so many times where when people, you know, forgive themselves, forgive others, dive into their spiritual practice and focus on healing the emotional traumas, then their body improves, their body heals. Their body can even reverse cancer and other diseases. So, I mean, these are all, you know, laid out in the Bible as well. But I wanted to ask this to you as well, really quick, is what if, here's a question I had, what if Jesus was never crucified, right? What if Jesus was never crucified? He knew he was going to be crucified, right? It talks about, he not only knew that they would mock him and scourge him and spit on him and kill him, right? This is Mark. He knew for certain that they would crucify him. That's Matthew 20:19. He knew it was coming. And I think he knew it needed to happen. And I think had it not happened, he would have gone down as another teacher in history, like many other wise sages before him from India and Tibet and Thailand and all over the world that have had great impact in the world in different ways through their spiritual teachings. But without the crucifixion, I don't think we would have had such an explosion in, you know, Christianity all around the world, and the Bible and all, you know, everything that came from that, you know, spreading all around the world. I don't think we would have that without it. So I think he knew that it needed to happen for his teachings to reach the world in such a massive way. That's my perception.
Wow. It's amazing that you say that, because I haven't heard many people come to that conclusion in that way and for that reason. And I do believe that was God's, you know, wisdom and the ultimate that's the ultimate love, when you realize if that bullet wasn't even coming from God, that so it wasn't a death sentence that was against you. So imagine, right? So this is the typical understanding where God has a bullet, he's shooting it at you. Christ comes and takes the bullet instead. He intercepts and it, you know, goes through him. And what that does is it creates a, you know, this rep, you know, love for Christ for what he did, but then this disconnection with God, his father, for why he would do this. You know, why would God do this to me? And so, you know, that belief, it has this, it's, but you can't convince somebody that it's not true because it's so deep in them. And because, you know, we all require penalties like this. You turn on a Jurassic Park film and you start realizing that these dinosaurs are like objects of their God's wrath manifested, and they're punishing everyone for their sins. Like, watch what happens. It's when they're greedy, when they're gluttonous, it's always the ones that are overweight, which is so cruel when you think about, hold on a second, this is how much do you hear people, you know, judge and talk about each other and their body and their weight? And, you know, people with children, you got to be really careful. You might have a reflection, but you say that in front of your children, they start thinking that it's okay to value people differently based on their bodies. You know, it doesn't mean we can't be better. And we talk about, you know, the challenge, and we have to talk about it like a health thing, so we know what we're striving for. But if it's in a conversation of value, then that's cruel. And so you see all this happen, and you know, people are getting punished for all these things. And so then you flip it the other way. Now you see, okay, God knew that this was the thing that would touch the heart. And it would do something for the human soul that nothing could. And it would pay the price. It would meet the atonement, which is a fascinating word. So it's three words. Atonement is used for blood sacrifice. If you hear the word, you think, if you've heard it before, you think, okay, it's a word to denote sacrifice, blood sacrifice. But the word is three words, at-one-ment, atonement. It's the same root word for reconciliation. And so it's something that has a dual meaning. So in the minds of people, it's like it's a blood sacrifice. And through blood, we can now achieve the making right of things, and it settles the score. And now everything's okay, right? Because the problem's been dealt with. There's been a sentence. It's why you see cases where they can't find the murderer, and then they'll actually pin it on somebody else. And they know that that's incorrect, but it's the cases go forward. You know, one case was the movie Just Mercy with Michael B. Jordan, and you've got Arthur McMillan, known as Johnny D, who was pinned for a rape and murder, and it wasn't him. And the people, you know, all the people, basically, you watch the movie or watch the documentaries, and they knew it wasn't him. And he did get out eventually, but the society was basically just standing back going, well, you know, someone has to pay. Green Mile is an example where it's a fictitious film, but he has to pay. It wasn't
That's such a good story, by the way. That's one of the first, I'd say that's one of the first like thick books I ever read in my life. And I was a young teenager, and I remember reading it in Bozeman, Montana, lived with my mom. And I think my younger brother was still living with us. I hadn't been kicked out yet. And I hadn't, you know, been as deep down that dark rabbit hole as I did, you know, a few years later. And I remember, and that book was, I mean, that book still, the story still sticks with me today. Now, the film is really good too, but the book, you know, was amazing. You know, and that, so anyway, if anyone hasn't read The Green Mile, I do recommend it.
Yeah, and it's all about this substitutional atonement. Atonement, blood sacrifice, or not necessarily the meaning of the word, because it's actually just two parties coming together. But in this context, absolutely, blood sacrifice, and then substitution. So that somebody has to do it instead of, because I can't pay my own debt. If I do, then I'm lost forever, and I don't want that. So this death in my place, it is so beautiful because it meets you where you're at. And that's to me why it's caught wind, because we've all got this inner knowing that there's something wrong. And then under our own system, there needs to be retribution, which to me it's the satanic concept. It's interesting why Christ is not referred to on the cross as like a lamb, a white lamb on an altar. It's actually referred to as a snake. John 3:14, as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so shall also the Son of Man be lifted up. So he's referred to as a serpent on a pole, which is crazy to think about. Why are you referring to yourself as like a serpent, which is like the source of all evil from Genesis? But when you look at the cross and you see someone lacerated, he got 39 lashes twice, no flesh on his torso, with that kind of, you know, with a Roman scourge with metal in it to rip your flesh. And you see him on the cross, you know, weeping, and you realize that it's evil. Like, that is evil. That's not justice. It's satanic justice. And that's what that is teaching. And it's a mirror of the soul. And so the serpent was actually made out of brass. Brass is not a naturally occurring metal, which is, if you look at the sanctuary, it says, "Thy way, O God, is in the sanctuary." It's filled with teachings. It's the holy and most holy place are filled with gold and silver as the metals, and then some wood, all God made. But the altar of sacrifice is not made out of a God made metal. It's made out of brass, or bronze, which is an alloy of zinc and copper. And the first mirrors are also made out of brass. So when you commit a sacrifice, you see your own reflection. You see your own soul. It's telling you what you are. So you look at the cross and you say, this is what I required. And he's now facing the penalty that I put upon him. And this now is, and because now I can see this, this is my way through salvation, because it's meeting me where I'm at, but not because God needed a death to save me, because I needed a death to save me. And this is why you see all the passages that talk about reconciliation, none of them talk about God reconciling with man. It all talks about man reconciling with God, which means that we were the offended party, the one that needed to have the war that we had reconciled, which was in, you know, you look at the passages that say, when we were enemies, not when God was our enemy, we were reconciled to God by the death of his son. So that was what caused the human heart to then respond to God. And then now the beautiful thing, this thing's happening together all at once. So that's the darkness, the captive, the need for that penalty to be settled in my own psyche and conscience as I have now mandated it. Now what's happening at the same time is God's love and forgiveness is being extended irrespective of the cruelty that's being inflicted on him. And then that love is now being extended to me. I see myself in this picture. And so on a personal note, Nathan, like, I absolutely see myself in this picture, and I see myself as being an offender, not as an innocent bystander. And then you'd say, well, you know, that sounds pretty self-loathing, or, you know, why you never did that. And, you know, you do good things out there. You know, why would you associate yourself with that? And it's like, well, you read an eulogy and it's all the positive things, but I know the other things, the things that have gone in my head, my mind, the difficulties, the heartbreak, the poor choices I've made, the people I've hurt. And so, you know, God is now, you know, extending that forgiveness to me in this situation where I really don't think I deserve it at all. And so it's taken things to the breaking point, and I'm loved and accepted. Now, if I can accept it here, this is the only opportunity. So the cross is now why it's the centerpiece of Christianity, because it's the thing that makes you realize that God loves you and accepts you, and that there's no restriction to his love, and that you see yourself as in this story and embraced and loved. And in the truest sense, now when you see that God didn't require the sacrifice and you realize it came from yourself, Christ talked about this. He says to the Pharisees, go and learn what this means. They were saying tax collectors and sinners deserve to be gotten rid of, basically. That was the meaning of what they're saying. He says, I desired mercy and not sacrifice. And go and learn. I deserve mercy, and go and learn what this means, and I'll have mercy and not sacrifice. So it was mercy instead of sacrifice. That's the way of God. And anyway, so you then start to see yourself as up, you know, caught up in this beautiful picture, and realize that your forgiveness is there for you. And this was the healing power. If I was to tell you one thing that healed me more than anything else when it came to sexual addiction, it was this. And I was the guy that, you know, nothing could really work. And because I didn't have the addiction where I was like, it was like an everyday thing, but when low points would hit, I couldn't stop my thoughts from racing in that way, looking for comfort. When my wife had sexual trauma and that she withdrew from me sexually, and then I felt so rejected, and that withdrawal was, you know, often underscored by very, you know, you know, outbursts of anger and things like this. And then so I feel, well, you know, I need to find peace and comfort. And so, and this really highlighted the fact that I didn't have that in God. And then going back and realizing, man, I'm just so deeply loved and cherished by God, and that I'm not under this penalty that I thought I was under that was causing me to explode and kind of lose my temper at times. And yeah, sure, sometimes do I lose my temper? Yeah, sure, sometimes things come up, but I can tell you it's night and day. And I can tell you that, you know, my wife would tell you that I'm a different person, and that I
know your wife really well. I'll ask her if your sexual addiction has truly been healed or not. She'll tell me.
Yeah, good. Hey, she's actually just came and sat in the corner over here so she can hear you.
Hey, Lori, what's happening?
So, yeah.
We'll get the truth one way or another.
Well, yeah, exactly. But no, husbands or partners or whatever can easily keep secrets like that from their wives. So you really only can ever really fully know within yourself. And so, right? You know what I mean?
No, it's true. And so I know we have 2 minutes left. So just to kind of wrap up, I think the one thing I want to say is, you know, I encourage anyone, you know, all of you tuning in, listening to this now, is to ask yourself these questions, to meditate and pray to God and ask for guidance on these things we spoke about, and see where in your own life maybe you feel the need to sacrifice yourself, that there is this sacrificial part of you that is driving your life, that there is this deep-rooted subconscious ideas and beliefs that are driving your life to either continue, you know, sinning and harming others and harming yourself, even in subtle ways. And that this subconscious belief that we cannot control that. And it is, you know, embedded deeply within us, because I know from my own experience, these are things that we can become masters of, that we can heal within ourselves, that we can, through Christ and through God and through, you know, these divine teachings, even these teachings, like I said, that I've studied from ancient traditions all around the world, they teach the very, very, very similar things. And in fact, the Vedas teach a science of how to enlighten our minds to a point where we no longer have a single negative thought or sinful thought. And there are many people who have gotten to that level. And I believe the stories that I've read, one of those stories, it's a wonderful story, I highly recommend people read, is the autobiography of a yogi. It's about Paramahansa Yogananda's life, who came here to the West from India in the mid-1900s. He basically brought yoga here to the West. And his life is an incredible story. I mean, and the teachers that taught him, Sri Yukteswar, has a really great explanation about Genesis and Adam and Eve and that whole, I won't get into it right now, but you can look it up, or he talks about in his book. You know, it gives you a different perspective, and kind of similar to what you're talking about, Jonathan, but I think even deeper in some regards, where this man was incredibly wise and was able to explain the deeper symbolic meanings of Genesis and the creation story and Adam and Eve, that I think is so profound. But you know, I encourage people tuning in, I mean, don't take our word for it, obviously, and discover this for yourself, meditate on it, prayer, you know, pray to God, ask for guidance, reflect and see in your own life where your love for God and your love, your desire to be your highest self, your best self, your truest self, your purest self, your Christ-like self, right? As Christ was teaching us, remember, Christ is not Jesus's last name, right? He was Jesus of Nazareth. And back then, no good things came out of Nazareth, which was very interesting, right? So it was very, quite the paradox for people to go, what, the Messiah came from Nazareth? It's coming from Nazareth? That doesn't even make sense. Nothing good comes out of Nazareth. But that Christ is the divinity, the God expression of Jesus, and the Christ-like life that Jesus led and brought to us to show us the way to God. And so that's how I perceive that. And every day, I'm certainly not perfect and make mistakes and have negative thoughts, but I can tell you, 20 years ago until now, I have, you know, overcome so many things, and I have less negative thoughts than ever before, and I live an amazing life now, and I've healed many addictions, and, you know, I've transcended so many of these subconscious beliefs that were sabotaging my life, and there's still more to do and more traumas to heal, but I'm a testament that it's possible to get out of poverty and homelessness and drug addiction and sex addiction and alcohol addiction and cigarette addiction and processed food addiction and negative thinking addiction. I was a terrible, terrible person. If anyone sinned more than anybody else, it was definitely me. And to, you know, overcome that to where I am now in my life, it's a testament to literally what Jesus teaches us, how to be like Christ, how to be Christ-like. And so that's what I'm trying to do every day.
It's beautiful. Thank you, Nathan. What a beautiful testimony. And, you know, I see that in you, and I'm grateful for all the help that you gave recently out in Kenya, and the fact that you're in for the long while, and that's rare. And so thank you for your heart for people. I see it strongly and clearly, and appreciate your friendship, brother.
Yeah. Thank you, brother. I love talking with you, man. I learn from you every time. And, you know, I think the first conversation we had like this was I was in San Diego a few years ago, and we had a phone call. I don't know if you remember, and I was, even a few years ago, I was reluctant to kind of, I was very interested. No, I wasn't reluctant then. I was reluctant before that to go into deep conversations about Jesus and the Bible. By the time you and I spoke, I was very excited about it, right? And I was just like, I just ask you questions and share ideas and pick your brain. I realized, wow, Jono is brilliant when it comes to, you know, understanding the Bible and seeing it from an incredibly higher perspective. So, dude, I love our time together. I appreciate this conversation deeply, and I look forward to doing it again with you.
Look forward to it too, brother. Thanks for your time, Nathan.
All right. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Nathan Crane Podcast. Please make sure to subscribe and share this on social media. Then head over to NathanCrane.com for your free ebook.
So when we're talking about, you know, what are these underlying causes and conditions of these chronic diseases, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, they all have very similar, if not identical, causes. And that's the thing, is when we get to the root cause of these diseases, we can not only prevent these diseases from ever happening, but empower our bodies to heal from them.
In every one of our cells, we have tens and hundreds of thousands of chemical reactions that are happening every second that are cycling back and forth. It's like sort of a yin and yang.
And, you know, for me, the soul's purpose is evolution. It doesn't care about comfort, it cares about evolution. Mm. And so I think so long as we are following our soul, then we will evolve. And I think what sometimes blocks us from living our purpose, from manifesting that next level of our expression, is we have not evolved.
There is also a time for letting go all the expectations and relax and just breathe and be grateful for what you have achieved.